Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What did the North American Free Trade Agreement do for the continent, and what would happen to the U.S., Mexico, and Canada if we broadened its provisions? To the extent that the trade gains of NAFTA peaked in 2001 and have fallen ever since, some critics argue the measure was a failure overall. But my guest sees it differently, arguing that the problem was never with the effort to bring Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. into a tighter alliance for trade, security, and development, but that the policies of NAFTA simply didn't go far enough to forge a trilateral bond. Robert A. Pastor is professor of international relations and director of the Center for North American Studies at American University. His new book is called The North American Idea, A Vision of the Continental Future. Robert, welcome to Think.
It's good to be with you.
What is the North American Idea?
The North American Idea is based on an understanding that the relationship between three sovereign countries, the United States, Canada and Mexico, should be deepened, should be more collaborative, and if we succeed in doing that, we will not only improve the competitiveness of each of our countries and our own security, but at the same time, we'll serve as a model for the rest of the world, because I think that we can succeed as a group of three countries. This region is the most powerful in the whole world. But if we don't find a new way of collaborating, we will be unable to deal with many of the challenges that have become chronic problems.
You know, it's interesting because if you meet someone from Europe, they may think of themselves as a Spaniard or a French person, but they also sort of really see themselves as Europeans. And you write that the idea of North America hasn't really entered our consciousness. Can you talk about the primary reasons for that?
The primary reason is that there is nobody really speaking about North America as a whole. I think each of our three countries, but particularly the United States, has become hyper-nationalistic, almost feeling as if we can go it alone, that we don't need friends, we don't need allies, that we could do it all by ourselves. But I think the nature of the international system now is that we do need friends and allies, and there are things for us to learn from other countries as well. So I think that's one reason. There's just simply been nobody who has stood up and articulated a vision of the United States as a sovereign nation with very close neighbors who are our closest friends who are working together with us. You know, as you pointed out correctly, in Europe, nobody asks, are you a Frenchman or a European? Because most Frenchmen would say, we're Frenchmen. But if they do ask, are you a Frenchman and also a European? Yes, they tend to say that's the case. In the case of North America, very few people do ask the same question. But when they do, what is surprising is that a good quarter of our population in each of the three countries do view ourselves as not only national of our own country, but also continental, see ourselves as part of something larger. And that's particularly surprising because nobody's bothered to make the case for it yet.
And so we in the United States, when we have an issue with Mexico or with Canada, we go, in fact, issue by issue rather than creating this long-term continent-wide agenda. What are the consequences of that approach?
The main consequence is that we don't seem to ever resolve our problems. They go on for a long time, and the main reason is that a lot of these problems are domestic in scope. We don't think of immigration or labor mobility or the environment or of energy as a continental challenge. We think of it as a domestic challenge, and so therefore, you know, if Mexico or Canada comes to us and say, look, the border is not working, and we need to set new rules that are uniform and that apply in a fair way, the United States says, yes, it's courteous, but it never quite reached the point where it engages our legislatures who make these decisions or our bureaucracies who are quite autonomous and difficult to deal with. As a result, these problems remain chronic challenges that are just not solved.
Tell us a little bit about the early history of NAFTA, which in its first 7 years or so seemed like a grand success.
If you assess NAFTA in terms of the objectives that it set, which were to dismantle trade investment barriers and increase trade investment, NAFTA was an astonishing success. In the first 7 years of NAFTA, the average annual growth rate in trade among the three countries was 18%. We tripled trade. We quintupled foreign direct investment. Those like Ross Perot that are afraid of this great sucking sound taking jobs away from America were completely wrong. This was the period of the most unprecedented growth in jobs, 23 million in the United States. So those first 7 years were absolutely astonishingly successful. Now, the problem is that most people blame NAFTA for problems that NAFTA was never designed to accomplish. They blame NAFTA for not stopping illegal migration. They blame NAFTA for not increasing energy production in Mexico or in the United States. They blame it for environmental problems. And the truth is that that was not what NAFTA's purpose was. And, in fact, it was the failure of our leaders in the three countries to find a way to deepen the North American community, to use the platform of dramatic success in trade and investment to take our integration to another level, which would have vastly improved our countries. It was their failure to govern this North American space and create a seamless continental market that led to many of those problems becoming worse and worse. It's ironic that NAFTA has been blamed for it. NAFTA was not intended to address them. The real blame should go for our leaders for not taking it to a new level to solve those problems.
Why did the gains of NAFTA in terms of international trade peak in 2001 and never restore the sort of top volume?
Well, first of all, trade and investment have continued to grow since 2001, but at a much declining rate. Basically, trade has grown among the three countries in North America since 2001, but at less than two-thirds of what it had grown before that. And foreign direct investment has grown at half of the rate of before that. So integration, or rather trade and investment, has continued to increase, and indeed our two largest markets for U.S. goods in the world are not China and not Japan. They're not England. They're not Germany. They happen to be Canada and Mexico. And in fact, we also saw that the proportion of the world product produced by North America, which had soared from the beginning of NAFTA, where it was 30%, to 2001, where it was 36%, has subsequently declined to about 29%. So we peaked in a number of different ways in 2001. Why? I think there are multiple reasons why. I think the first was 9/11. After the terrorist attack on the United States, we created new barriers to trade and investment among our three countries, mostly by the United States, which reduced the positive impact of NAFTA. Secondly, China entered the World Trade Organization, and it did extremely well. It surpassed Mexico as the second largest source of imports into the United States in 2003, and in 2007 it surpassed Canada. Thirdly, we didn't fulfill all of the promises of NAFTA. We promised Mexico, for example, that their trucks would be permitted into the United States, but we never fulfilled that. For 15 years, finally, after they won several suits in the International Trade Organization and NAFTA panels, we decided to allow them, but we have been very rough on allowing them, and they have chosen not to make the kinds of investments that would be needed to come into the United States for fear that if they did, the U.S. would just block them coming in again. We haven't, in fact, invested in infrastructure. Trade increased three times, and 80% of the trade is by roads, but we've built no new roads. We have fallen back to a dual bilateralism. Instead of trying to work things out as a community of three nations, the U.S. works with Canada, it works separately with Mexico, and very little progress is made. And I guess the final reason is that there hasn't been a large vision of North America. There haven't been lean institutions that have proposed ideas to move forward in North America. And as a result, we've fallen backwards.
Compare, if you would, the attitudes about a North American idea, North American alliance, as it is reflected in the United States as compared with Mexico and Canada.
Well, I think that NAFTA, as I said, became almost a piñata for pandering pundits like Lou Dobbs and Bill O'Reilly and politicians as well. Because it was blamed for things that it wasn't responsible for. And as a result, we became more nationalistic. I think people like Lou Dobbs would argue that our sovereignty was jeopardized. Now, if you spend any time in Mexico or Canada, the idea that the United States should be fearful of an embrace with our two neighbors is totally absurd. These countries are much smaller, much weaker, than the United States. Our GDP is 10 times the size of Canada and 20 times the size of Mexico. So the idea that we could be taken over by Canada and Mexico, which was, of course, the argument of Lou Dobbs and Bill O'Reilly, is absurd, but nonetheless, it got legs and began to run, and politicians began to run away from the North American idea. I think that was a mistake, but I think that has been one of the consequences of a failure to lead and to help Americans understand why our future would be much better off by closer relations with our two closest neighbors.
What about fears in Mexico and Canada about loss of sovereignty? I don't think anyone at this point thinks that the United States is going to invade, but there are questions about who will control certain industries. Is it reasonable for them to be more suspicious of an agreement like this?
Both Mexico and Canada were very fearful initially about NAFTA. They were fearful that the dismantling of investment barriers would lead American corporations to buy up all their industrial assets. What happened, however, was that the growth of foreign direct investment in all three countries increased exponentially, but the share owned by the United States declined. So the fears that Canada and Mexico had of being taken over declined as well. The great irony is that the country that has proven the boldest in thinking about North America is the one that's the weakest, Mexico, the one that was the most nationalistic and the most fearful of any interaction with the United States. In fact, about 20 years ago, I wrote a book with a later foreign minister of Mexico, Jorge Castañeda, called Limits to Friendship, in which we wrote that Mexico deliberately defined the limits to friendship with the United States for fear that if they were embraced by the United States, they would be suffocated. That has changed 180 degrees. They're now willing to pay a price of a customs union, a common external tariff, which would be higher for them than for anybody else. They have been the boldest in proposing new North American ideas.
My guest is Robert A. Pastor. He's professor of international relations and director of the Center for North American Studies at American University. His new book is called The North American Idea, A Vision of a Continental Future. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert A. Pastor, who's professor of international relations and director of the Center for North American Studies at American University. His new book is called The North American Idea, A Vision of a Continental Future. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Robert, I want to talk a little bit more about labor mobility, which, of course, is something that has really transformed the EU. I was very interested to read in this book that both Mexicans and Americans, people in the United States, are entirely comfortable with the idea that part of their labor force might move north for better opportunities. And yet both Canada and the United States are resistant to further opening their southern borders to labor moving north.
Yes, it is very interesting, looking at it from different directions. I think it certainly is practical that the U.S. and Canada could open up the borders to greater labor mobility, because the income gap between Canada and the United States is not very, very great. Canadians and Americans, you know, they see opportunities across the border. It should be easier for them to do it. In the case of Mexico and the United States, however, I think it would be It has to be done very incrementally and carefully, because the income gap is so large. And, you know, there are public opinion polls in Mexico that indicate a large number of people would like to move north if they could legally do so. And I think it would, frankly, dislocate both countries. We are seeing, over time, a growing population of Mexican Americans in the United States, and I think we have assimilated that well, and I think the Mexican Americans are playing a very positive and important role in the United States, and that role will continue to grow in many ways. But we do need to manage it better. I think that it needs to be legal and not undocumented, as it has been, or has at least a half to 60% have been undocumented. And I don't think that's good for either country as well. So what we want to do is, from the U.S. standpoint, obviously we want to continue immigration. We're still a large immigration-receiving country. That's a source of strength in the United States. I think we should give preferences to our two neighbors as our economies become more wedded into a single market. But we also have to have comprehensive immigration reform if we're going to do it right.
Are there particular challenges to uniting Mexico and Canada, given that they each have this giant hegemon between them that might seem to interfere with their recognition of their common interests as two separate countries?
Mexico has been much more open to a relationship with Canada than Canada has been with Mexico, and I think that's very unfortunate and a little puzzling for me, to be honest. I think the Canadians feel that their relationship with the United States is so close and so special that they would prefer not to associate with Mexico, but I believe they're making a mistake. Americans and Congress in particular are much more sensitive to the importance of Mexico because in part of the growing population. In the year 2015, there may be more Mexicans and Mexican origin citizens living in the United States than there are Canadians, as many as 35 million. So this is a source of constituent power in the United States that if the Canadians were wise, they would establish a better relationship with Mexico, and it might prove beneficial to their economic interests at the same time it is to Mexico and the United States.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Arthur in Dallas. Hello, Arthur.
Hello there. Just kind of wondering if the idea of a potential North American idea is not possible owing to, and you keep quoting or referencing the EU, where you have a range of relatively equal countries, both geographically and population-wise, in close proximity. It's not as if one is between the other or there's like an ABC kind of linkage which exists in North America. And as such, it's easier to view yourself as a European, combined with the fact that you've also got, I mean, the EU is everything from a customs union to a range of things, political union, that I doubt if North America in the immediate future is going to evolve into. And I'm just wondering as well, too, I think, you know, you missed out on the FTA, which precedes NAFTA, but that's a side issue. Is it something that is possible because of the discrepancies between amongst the three countries, as well as the outlook amongst the three of them, and different goals? I mean, the U.S. certainly has a world-girdling goal as, a guarantor of freedom of the seas and things like that. You know, you mentioned close partners. Mexico, for example, does not participate outside of its own country militarily the way Canada does with the U.S. So once again, you've got a variety of very large differences beyond some of the obvious ones.
Well, what do you think about all that, Robert?
Arthur is right. Europe is very different than North America. Europe came together largely after two cataclysmic wars, which brought all of the countries together. They are also deeper nationalism in Europe, and they've been able to transcend. North America is characterized by three very different countries. One very powerful one, the United States, which is responsible for about 85% of the gross product and 99% of the military expenditures. So there's a great deal of asymmetry, unevenness among the three. Still, I think that Europe is a valid place to look, not to try to imitate or even to adopt what Europe has done, but to learn lessons from their experience. Lessons from where they've made mistakes, and the euro, of course, is a good place to look at that we would want to avoid, and lessons from their success that we would want to adapt to a very different model that exists in North America. Europe, on the one hand, created these vast, supranational, intrusive institutions. North America made the opposite mistake. It created almost none. But I think what it could do is create some lean advisory institutions that could propose continental ideas on ways to build it. If you look at the interaction of the three countries, the three reached a level of economic integration after 7 years by 2001, which was almost comparable to what Europe did after five decades. And if we set as our goal that we want to create a seamless market, which would be a platform for extraordinary competitiveness in the world, I think the three countries could collaborate on a strategy that would get us there without creating the problems that Europe has had. So I don't often use the analogy of Europe because I think the two models are quite different. I do believe, however, there is much to be learned from their experience in terms of what we want to avoid as well as what we want to adapt.
So Mexico's new president, Enrique Peña Nieto, takes office in 4 weeks. How different is his approach to the North American idea than his most recent predecessors?
Well, I think he is very much taken by the idea. I've actually had an opportunity to meet with him, have lunch with him, to discuss the issue with him, to give him my book, which is in Spanish as well as in English. I think that he, like a lot of Mexican leaders, understand that the future of Mexico is to a great extent tied in with its future with its two North American neighbors, and that there is a lot of things that we need to do together in terms of creating infrastructure and transportation, of promoting education among our three and improving education in all three, of creating a North American energy security a market, dealing with environmental problems. I think he understands that quite well. He's got big issues that he has to handle in Mexico, but my sense is he's got a broader vision of where Mexico and the three countries in North America should go.
What are the ramifications specifically for the U.S. and Canada of Peña Nieto's pledges to reopen the oil industry, at least in part, in Mexico to foreign investment?
Well, I think it's very positive, certainly positive for Texas and the oil industry in Texas, that Mexico might finally open itself up to new technology and to investment and to production. It will lead to greater security among the three countries of North America in terms of energy, mostly for the United States, because our two neighbors are major exporters. although we are increasingly an exporter of natural gas, which could go into Mexico in exchange for their own increase in oil. So I think his openness, his willingness to consider a sacred cow of Mexico, which is, of course, Pemex and energy, is very encouraging. Hopefully, both the U.S. and Canada can also consider addressing sacred cows that they've been unwilling to consider up until now.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the phone, we will speak with Clayton in Dallas. Hi, Clayton.
Hi. I was wondering, one of the criticisms I hear of NAFTA is that it's not really free trade. And on that, why not just pursue an elimination of all trade barriers and tariffs between the three countries, or even unilaterally just the U.S. removing all tariffs between Canada and Mexico?
Well, I certainly would favor a complete and open continental market, but I don't think it's fair to say that these are not free trade agreements. They are, and indeed, almost all of the all of the tariffs have been removed, and almost all of the barriers to trade and investment among the three countries have been removed as well. There are a few protected areas of the three economies, you know, whether it's some portions of agriculture like sugar in the United States or dairy in the U.S. and Canada, and trucking, as I mentioned before. But by and large, there is a fair amount of free trade. I think the next major hurdle is for us to come up with a common external tariff. And if we did so, it would eliminate a tax on the border and also bureaucracy on the border against legitimate commerce, a tax that might amount to as much as $500 billion a year. It's rules of origin that are imposed as a result of the fact that we have different external tariffs. So that would be a very positive force for increasing and improving the market among the three countries.
Now, just to explain to people, the rules of origin procedures essentially make sure that other countries don't come in and choose the country of the three in North America that has the lowest tariffs. Is that right, to export their goods directly to?
Excellent. That's exactly right.
I only know that because of your book, so thank you.
when we moved from three countries to a free trade area, we decided to remove tariff and other trade barriers among our three countries, but we left our external tariffs to the rest of the world where they were. And in order to prevent Japan, for example, or China taking advantage of the country with the lowest tariff in order to export to all three, we set rules of origin, which meant that each time a truck or a train comes to the border, we would have to establish how much of that product was made in North America, and that part which was not, we would put a tariff on it. In the end, this is such a costly impediment and a bureaucratic impediment that a lot of companies didn't even bother to use the free trade system at all. They just used most favored nation. So it led to an effective tax, not only on the border, but in terms of our distorted effect on our three economies, which could be eliminated simply by the three countries agreeing to have all three sets of tariffs the same. From the U.S. standpoint, this would benefit us the most because actually our tariffs are the lowest right now, so we would pay the least. Mexico, ironically, has been most supportive of it, even though their tariffs are the highest and they would have to pay the most. But overall, North American commerce and competitiveness would improve dramatically if we moved from a free trade area to a common external tariff.
What kind of expanded collaboration could we explore with regard to environmental preservation and things like that?
I think a lot. I think all three countries accept basic environmental principles. They all have a set of environmental laws. And I think that to the extent that these principles were harmonized, I think we would deal better with the environment. After all, the air and the sky and the water, are continental and global. They're not purely national. They don't just stop at the border. And if we're concerned about air pollution, for example, or if we're concerned about climate change, then, you know, it's not enough for each country to work out a policy, and indeed all three countries are having difficulty working out any policy. It would be far better if all three countries agreed to a single set of policies or a single approach to many of these environmental problems.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Adil is on the line now in Plano. Hi, Adil.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
And thanks for taking my call. My question is, have we lost an opportunity in the last 15, 20 years moving our manufacturing, everything, let's say, to China and other countries versus keeping within the NAFTA? And is it because of our political leaders, they didn't stand up, or can it be revived, or can we still keep some by reviving the NAFTA? Thanks.
Thanks for your call. Were you able, that was a kind of a tough connection. Were you able to understand the question, Robert?
Not completely. Perhaps if you could just
Yeah, Adil was asking if we had lost an opportunity in moving certain manufacturing jobs to China that we ought to have preserved in North America by allowing them to go to places like Mexico. I hope that I'm interpreting the question correctly.
Yeah, I think we did. I think we lost a huge opportunity. And I think there should be an important lesson for us, because it will come back to haunt us if we haven't learned the lesson. And that is that we would be far better off if our three countries work together, not only in improving our competitiveness, but even in approaching trade policy, than if we do it each country working alone. We are currently engaged in this exercise called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, of negotiating with about 8 smaller countries in Asia. It would be far better if the three countries of North America first agreed among themselves before we approach Asia or before we approach China. We would be better off.
Robert A. Pastor is with us. He's professor of international relations and director of the Center for North American Studies at American University. His new book is called The North American Idea, A Vision of a Continental Future. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert A. Pastor, professor of international relations and director of the Center for North American Studies at American University. His new book is called The North American Idea, A Vision of a Continental Future. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Robert, I want to come back to this issue of transportation infrastructure. And you mentioned that 80% of the goods that move between Mexico and the U.S. and Canada move by truck, which would sort of point to a need for better roads, more roads. If we were to agree to a sort of tri-national agreement to do this, would each country ideally be responsible for funding this itself? Would there be a big pool that each would contribute to? How would that best work?
Well, I think the first and most important thing, and it would be wonderful if the new newly elected president tomorrow would announce it on his side, and the newly elected president of Mexico joined together with the prime minister of Canada, and ask their three ministers or secretaries of transportation to work together to develop a single continental plan for infrastructure and transportation. What Eisenhower did for the United States, is now time to think about it continentally. There aren't really roads that take advantage of this emerging market. Now, how could this plan then move its next step? If we look towards deepening economic integration by moving towards a customs union, then that permits all of the tariffs for all three countries to be collected together. And that money, which would amount to maybe about $40, $45 billion a year, could then go into a fund for transportation infrastructure that would implement this plan. Now, the key thing for understanding this, particularly from Dallas and Texas' point of view, is that we're not talking about border infrastructure. We're talking about continental infrastructure. Ultimately, the best way to reduce undocumented migration from Mexico to the United States would be by reducing the income gap, because Mexicans come up for higher wages. And the best way to reduce the income gap would be to invest in the south and center of Mexico, where much of the labor is coming from to the border, where they're attracted as a magnet by the new industry there, and then going north. So if you had a North American idea that talked about our three nations as a part of a community in which success by one will lead to success by all three, and if you had a North American plan for infrastructure and transportation together with the objective of a seamless market, then the common fund that comes from a common external tariff could be used to finance this infrastructure that could bring people, that could bring Chiapas in southern Mexico together with northern Ontario in new routes that would benefit from this increased trade and that would lift all three economies.
How significant would you say that cultural differences are between the three countries as impediments to international cooperation?
I think cultural differences were once impediments to greater cooperation and sources of stereotypes by one people against another. But I think this has changed so much over the last 20 or 30 years as we're dealing with a globalized culture in which television and novelas are seen on all the sides in all three countries. The United States itself is a sum of cultures of all over the world. There's not a single U.S. culture. There are multiple cultures. And we've learned a lot from Mexico, certainly in Texas. There's a huge Mexican culture in Texas, and there's a huge American culture in Mexico, and the same applies in Canada as well. So I think people increasingly understand that culture is a source not only of diversity, but of enhancing our human experience, and therefore not something to be feared.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time on the line, we have David in Fort Worth. Hi, David.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've often said if you look at all the things going on in the world, or at least my observation is that we're pretty blessed in the United States to have the two countries that border us. So there's a lot of choices. It could have ended up any way, but we get Canada and we get Mexico. Canada is a standalone country, has a strong economy, and I think that Mexico has a beautiful culture and heritage of family and hard work. Does not come without its challenges. So my question to the point is more towards Mexico. I think that there are two issues. The undocumented worker issue is obviously a large issue for political will, Texas and Arizona and those kinds of states. But to another topic, I wonder what ideas you have about the somewhat recent and severe drug cartel issues that might convolute the actual politics towards moving towards, as you mentioned, letting Mexican trucking enter our borders. And I'll take your comments and thoughts off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
David, I think your question is an excellent one, and I like where you started. The truth is that from a security standpoint, there are no two countries in the world more important to the United States than Canada and Mexico. We fought wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but if our two neighbors weren't cooperative and friends of ours, we would really have our security jeopardized. I mean, the number of people who could cross that border who would want to do harm to the United States would be great, and so we should never take our two neighbors for granted. And never take the security issue for granted either. We are very fortunate to have two neighbors that we have a good relationship with. Now, there is no doubt that in recent years, both the undocumented migration problem from Mexico, not exclusively from Mexico, but maybe two-thirds of the undocumented population have come from Mexico, and also the drug-related violence have influenced the perception by Americans of Mexico and made some Americans think that we shouldn't have anything to do with it and we should build larger and bigger walls and barriers and fences to keep Mexico out. The truth is that we share responsibility for both problems. If there weren't jobs in the United States looking for cheaper labor, and if Mexicans didn't work as hard as they do when they come to the United States, then I don't think there would be an undocumented migration problem in the United States. And if there wasn't demand in the United States for drugs, if there weren't money paying for those drugs, if there weren't guns coming down from the United States into Mexico, then the drug-related violence in Mexico would be much less, if not completely absent. So to the extent that we understand that we are a part of each of these problems and that therefore we need to be a part of the solutions, and we need to think hard about how we could contribute to the solutions, I think we'd be on a far better path than to simply blame Mexico for undocumented migration and for drugs as well.
Let's speak next on the phones with Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello. In the late 70s, I worked at Ellis Island, New York City, and I had the opportunity to speak to many immigrants who returned to the island, and they all loved their own original country. They would have loved to have stayed if they could. Oftentimes, they went back. It's my unscientific opinion that that's the same with people from Mexico, that if they could come and go, they would, and that the whole labor issue is skewed because of all of the immigration policies. And I'm wondering if you have any support for my, like I say, unscientific view that if they could go back and they do it easily, they would, and have a lot less of this problem.
Well, I think you're right that most people who immigrate to the United States for economic reasons would like to go back after they amassed some funding and some support. I think that economic migrants in particular always feel much more tied to their homeland than, for example, political refugees who know that the political system has changed and it's no longer welcoming them. But the truth is that most migrants do wind up staying. And they stay either because they come as young people and they marry and they have families and they decide and they put down roots, or because they're afraid that if they went back, they wouldn't live as well as they do before. So I think if there was greater labor mobility, I think a lot of people would return, but a lot of people would stay as well. And exactly how that breaks down would vary from country to country and from period to period, and the nature of the economic situation in both the home and the receiving country as well.
Let's go next on the phone to Irving. We have James on the line. Hello, James.
Hi. this is the first time I've called the show, but this is a great topic. This is something that we're dealing with on the southern end of Dallas County, with the toll roads that we've been fighting down there. Our toll road fight started with an intermodal port that was supposed to support the Trans-Texas Corridor in southern Dallas County. When that plan got nixed, we tried to find out, okay, why did we need this intermodal port? And I think I heard the speaker say that there is no comprehensive infrastructure plan, but what it came across in Texas was the former Trans-Texas Corridor, which doesn't just start and end in Texas. It starts at the port of Lazarus Cardenas in Mexico, which was a Chinese port, deep water port, that has twice the capacity of Long Beach and Seattle. And right now the plan from the North American Super Corridor Coalition is most of the Chinese goods now, including, will come up from that port and branch out from Texas east and west and north. But what I'm concerned with is most Americans don't realize that's a tolled rail car and utility. infrastructure. And can I get the speaker to address that?
Well, I think there have been a lot of creative ideas by people near the border. I think you've just described one from Texas. I think in San Diego, they've been working with Tijuana to internationalize the Tijuana airport and permit a corridor and a travel basis on both sides of the border. But I don't believe I've seen anything approaching a truly continental perspective that says, here are how these various sub-regional projects would fit in with a larger picture, a larger map of where we want to go in all of North America. I think the kinds of things you've mentioned are very useful. In some cases, it's precisely because they are very precise projects as opposed to projects that are integrated into a national plan or a continental plan that they have great difficulty in moving forward. If you look, you know, at the northern border between Canada and the United States, the Windsor Bridge between Windsor and Detroit is actually the most used bridge by commerce in the world between any two countries. That bridge was built in 1928. It's owned by a separate private family, and they've been resisting the building of any other bridge. The Canadians finally put up a lot of money to build a second bridge, and that family is doing everything to try to kill it in the United States. So there's the absence of a national and a continental vision, which is hampering some good regional efforts, such as the one that you've just described. And if you had that vision, then it would really enhance them a great deal.
We have less than a minute left, but can you talk about what an ideal 10-year North American plan might encompass?
Well, I think that we need to start with the idea that we can be three sovereign and independent countries, but work together as a community in a manner that would help all three. If you start with that idea, a lot will follow from it. The first place I would start with would be this plan for transportation infrastructure, the goal of a seamless market so that it is easy to trade and to do business between Chicago and Dallas as between Dallas and Mexico City, and then do more in education, setting up centers for research on North American studies, having our students study in each of our three countries to develop a better appreciation of that, and then have our three governments work together and try to collaborate on more comprehensive plans for building North America. That's where I'd like to see us 10 years from now, tomorrow.
The new book by Robert A. Pastor is called The North American Idea, A Vision of a Continental Future. Robert, it's been so interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for your excellent questions and particularly for the audience participation. I've enjoyed it very much.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can find out what's coming up on Think at KERA.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.